Good morning, Atlanta. I'm your host, Dana Barrett. And
good morning, Dana Barrett.
Good morning.
I am Elizabeth Gordon, and it is a good morning today here in the ATL.
That's right. It's Wednesday. What is it? March 14th?
That's right.
I think so.
St. Patrick's Day is coming up this weekend.
I know. And you know what? I just bought green pants, like completely coincidentally.
Nice.
And then the guy said to me when I was checking out, like, oh, those will be great for St. Patty's Day. And I thought, oh, really? I didn't even think about it. I'm not really a big St. Patty's Day drinker.
I kind of want to spend St. Patrick's Day with you just so I can see you in green pants.
I'm going to wear my green pants. I'm going to rock those green pants. Just telling you, man. All right. Introduce our guest, Elizabeth. Who do we have today?
We have two fabulous people in the studio with us this morning. Tom Creeley, who is the CEO of Ethics Firma, and Jennifer Schwartz, who's the owner of Jennifer Schwartz Gallery. These are amazing folks that I've had the privilege of kind of bumping into in the great community of Atlanta, and I invited them into the studio to have some good business conversation with us this morning. So ethics and art.
I love it. So good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. Have you guys had your coffee yet?
Have plenty of coffee this
morning.
All right. So you're pumped up and ready to go.
Ready.
All right. Before we get into ethics and art, and by the way, we're not necessarily going to make you guys come up with some ethics and art conversation that since, you know.
Oh, we could do it.
Absolutely.
We're ready.
I think you could.
Sure.
I think you could. And you could even work green pants into it, I bet.
I bet I could.
I think you could do a whole photography series on green pants. Just putting it out there.
You'll want to check this out later on the blog. The post-show green pants photography experiment.
That's right. I do want to give the listeners a little bit of the show is relatively new. So if this is your first time tuning in, welcome. We're glad to have you. And you should know that on this show, Good Morning Atlanta, we are not going to yell and scream about politics. So if that's what you're looking for.
Change the channel.
That's right. Wrong place. We are not going to aggravate you even further by giving you a traffic report when you already know that traffic sucks.
Right. So, if you're in your car, you're probably in your car in traffic.
Right. And chances are, if you're listening to us, you're not in your car. You're actually at your office already, or you're at home drinking coffee. And either way, you don't care what's happening on the roads. And guess what? You know what? I used to be a traffic reporter a long time ago. And
it's an angsty job.
Oh, God. It is the worst. I'm sorry. I appreciate the traffic.
Talk about the bearer of bad news.
It's like being a dentist, you know? It's just like bad news every day. There's a car fire on 280 frickin' 5, and who cares?
Yep.
You know what? You're going to be stuck. Drink your coffee. Change the channel. Listen to some music. Get your zen going because forget it.
Relax.
Yeah. So we won't be doing that. But we are going to hit some of the business headlines of the day. And we are going to hopefully have great guests every Wednesday morning to chat with us about what they're doing. And today is obviously no exception to very interesting, very different people here. So let's jump into that, I think.
Yeah. Let's start talking some business.
Yeah, do it, man. What do you got going on over there?
So there's been some interesting talk lately about construction projects going on in the city, as well as new jobs being created here in Atlanta. I was actually at the SHRM conference yesterday where we're doing the live broadcast.
That's right. Tell people what that stands for in case they don't know.
That's the Society of Human Resources Managers. It was at the Cobb Galleria, which is a great venue for a conference event like that. And a lot of people were talking to us about job creation and the interesting new projects that are going on in Atlanta. So everybody's very positive about economic development right now.
Which is kind of amazing because it's been pretty bad for a while. Do you feel like, all right, I'm going to totally shift gears a little bit, but do you feel like when the times get tough, people get more ethically challenged? Ethics question.
Ethics question. Actually, statistics have proven that people are much more cautious in taking ethical risk during hard times.
Really?
Absolutely.
Oh, see, I would have said the opposite.
That's what most people think. The Ethics Resource Center came out in December with some new statistics updating it, and it has shown that people are not willing to take the risk because they're afraid to lose their job.
Okay.
But
so what about the people that are already, I'm going to use a ridiculous word right now, but disenfranchised. What about the people that already lost their job and they're just looking for something to do? Are they more likely to be ethically challenged?
That's very possible because obviously they would not be in the survey
that
was conducted by the research group. And they may, depending on the level of desperation, they may be willing to take risk and to go to jail. I don't know if you saw in the news today and yesterday that one of the hottest items to steal is Tide detergent.
Really?
Yes. It is to the point that grocery stores are now putting locks on Tide. And I showed a man in a grocery store.
I see this story. This is funny.
Specifically that brand?
In the grocery store, yes. Particularly that brand because it is the number one seller of Tide of detergent.
That is really funny. I'm going to interrupt just for a second because I have to say that when money was flowing for me and I was like all in the big bucks, I used Tide. And now that I'm a little less...
we're generic.
Now I'm like, totally. I have to use the cheaper brand. Right. And I do kind of look longingly at the Tide and wish that I could get it.
It's definitely superior stuff. Having also been through various economic conditions.
It does make laundry
But it seems that would be difficult to steal.
Yeah, they're big bottles.
It's easier to steal.
He had a gross... basket with probably about 20 or more large containers of Tide.
And his running shoes on?
And he ran out of the grocery store with them. And so they're literally putting locks on Tide in grocery stores now.
Wow. That's sad.
But you can buy it very cheaply on the internet.
Well, because everyone's selling the stolen Tide.
Selling stolen Tide.
Who would have thunk
it? Black market Tide.
Yeah. So Tough Times brings out the creativity and like
the
creativity of that's like that fine line between entrepreneurship and where you're actually crossing an ethical barrier.
That's
here
right.
It's
yep.
like good for you for being slightly industrious, but if you can stay on the right side of the ethical line, that's where we really encourage you to
absolutely.
Be in business.
Yes.
Well, we actually don't care. You do whatever you want to do because we like to talk about it. Actually, it gives us more fodder for a conversation. But yes, among our friends, stay on the right side, please.
Yes.
So the Georgia Army Base won the World's Best Army Food Award.
Wow.
How about that?
Have you ever had Army food? Anybody? Were you guys?
I've had Navy food and Marine food.
I was going to say military.
We've got a military man with us here. So how important is the food
very
quality?
Important. When you have military, the most important thing for military men and women is their pay and their food. And they make sure that both of them are on time and very well done and cooked. So it's pretty palatable.
That's interesting.
Do they have regional cuisine? I mean, does Georgia have Southern and that's makes it better than, say,
they're allowed to do biscuits and...
Right. I mean, they're got mac and cheese and fried chicken. I mean, is it that or is it just the...
If you had to serve cereal, like...
How do you win?
Yeah.
Right. I think I wonder if we could get
it. Give you an advantage.
They might. A little butter, a little salt.
Well, matter of fact, some of the chefs actually go to the Culinary Institute of America and get training. They go through a couple of weeks training to add to what they have received in the military.
Oh.
So that helps to enhance the creativity in culinary arts in the military.
That's so funny. That is something I honestly have never given 1 ounce of thought to. In fact, I guess if I thought about it at all, I would assume the food was bad.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Slop.
Mess hall kind
like
of.
Right. You take those basic human needs and those become like the redeeming factors for all of the rest of the hardship difficultness of the mission at hand.
Interesting.
Exactly.
You've got those basic creature comforts.
Well, while we're talking about food and beverage, first of all, we need a breakfast sponsor. Someone, if we're going to do a show this early in the morning, someone needs to bring us some donuts. But I noticed another story in I think it was in the AJC business section, that Pepsi is about to roll out a new mid-calorie drink. Pepsi Next, exactly. And I was thinking to myself...
A mid-calorie
Mid-calorie, yes.
Are there any comparable?
No. And apparently this is something they've been trying for years. Apparently, according to the experts in business, there is some target demographic that is primarily men that don't want to drink a diet soda because it's too girly, but but they do realize they need to watch their calories a little bit. Yet no one has ever been able to actually sell anything to this particular demographic. And so if you're asking my opinion, which no one is, I think it's doomed to fail. That's my opinion. Doomed to fail.
Being in the middle is a very difficult niche to capture because
absolutely.
It's so sort of soft. And,
yeah.
And who wants to say, you know,
I'm indecisive.
Right.
I can't go.
I'm in the middle.
Right.
Yeah.
I can't go full sugar. I feel awkward drinking diet. I don't know.
Can you imagine the commercials for that? Like, you just have a guy walking on a fence. Like, I'm on the fence. Yep. You know?
It's just lots of pictures of very average looking men.
I'm ordinary.
Well, right. I don't know. Maybe
I don't stand out in a crowd.
Maybe there are a lot of
there are, but they don't want to think of themselves as that way.
No one self-identifies.
No, they want the
being in the middle.
Absolutely.
And yet, clearly the majority is in the middle.
I switched to Coke Zero when it came out.
See?
So I did not want the full sugar.
Right.
And I'm conscious about weight and working out.
Right.
And Coke
and
Zero
fabulous.
Came out. I took it, drank it, and
liked it.
Tasted like Coke.
Well, Coke Zero, it's interesting because in this article about Pepsi, Coke says, like, no, we're not doing a mid-calorie drink. We have Coke Zero, and that's hitting that target demographic. Mm-hmm. And that's what I found to be true. My guy friends that don't drink Diet Coke, drink Coke Zero.
And I think that Coke Zero, they're not saying you're indecisive. They're saying you want a diet drink that tastes more like the full sugar.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So you can still feel good about that choice. Good about yourself.
Now, we're in Atlanta town.
It's like you're getting away with something.
Right.
I get
exactly.
Sugar taste,
exactly.
And
sure.
I don't
can
have
it all.
That's right.
Right. And who doesn't want to have it all?
Right. And we have to be Coke fans because we're in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But I mean, Coke nailed it, I think.
I feel a little guilty even talking about Pepsi, I have to be honest.
Yeah, but we're Pepsi bashing, so it's okay.
Okay, good point.
I have no guilt.
That's because you're the ethics guy.
Right, right. You're saying we're okay.
Yeah, Coke Zero, though, not only are they selling amazingly well, they market it. It's a black can, it's like very manly, it's totally clearly geared to that market.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's working.
Right.
So I don't know what Pepsi's thinking.
What's it going to be called?
Pepsi Next. And then this is what I would, the other commercial, I'd be like, Next. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Remember when they did Clear Pepsi or whatever? Like, that was the weirdest thing ever. Did you ever taste that?
No.
So weird. Like, you felt like you were going to.
Because it freaked me out.
It's
looking
it was
at
bizarre.
It, like, that it's going to taste like a dark soda, but look like
a
light
Sprite.
Soda.
Right.
Yeah.
It was weird.
But aren't they doing something? They're taking this caramel coloring out of a lot of the colas because they don't want to have to put a cancer-causing
warning on it. Says
instead
it could kill you.
Right, they don't want to take it out because it can give you cancer. They want to take it out because they don't want to have to tell you it can give you cancer.
Ethics question. Ding, ding, ding.
Right.
Well, they're being proactive, and because
that's
FDA is coming down on them because they say if you don't change your formula for the color, caramel color, then we're going to put this warning that this can cause cancer. And it's also kind of in line with what's happened with cigarette companies and wanting to put the photographs of deteriorating lungs, cancerous lungs, and other things. So they're both companies are being proactive in their corporate social responsibility and getting ahead of the game with this. And so I'm sure their scientists are sitting there figuring out right as we talk what kind of formula they're going to use to change that color in order to ameliorate the whole situation.
But so how long have they been using this stuff? And it begs the question of, you know, the tobacco companies knew that they were causing cancer far before they decided to publicly admit that. So how
Coke's
long have...
Coke's 125 years old now, as of last year.
The recipe is...
So.
Yeah.
It's been out there.
Absolutely. It's been there for a while. So
at what point does it become a corporate responsibility to make a decision that's in the best interest of the public?
Well, and also, how many people have complained thinking that they're getting cancer when the probability may be minuscule?
There's so many things in our world today that cause cancer. It's hard to like identify exactly which one got you.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is,
it was
bacon I ate in 1982.
Right.
Like,
it was the caramel coloring in the soda. The
the
Coke I drink.
I love bacon. And I will eat bacon. So, you know, I do risk-benefit analysis. What do I love and what can I not do without? And what is a greater risk that I think I can do without? So that's how I work it out.
I was feeling yesterday I saw a bumper sticker about my religion is bacon. And I feel like I don't know who is the marketing person for bacon just as a general food group, but they're doing a great job
of selling
bacon. I mean, it's all you hear about. If you can get bumper stickers and you can get dental floss that's bacon flavored.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's all the
there's bacon festivals.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Chocolate covered bacon.
Totally. Yep. It's all bacon all the time.
That's a business genius right there.
It is. Because bacon couldn't be worse for you. However, it's
like popular and fun.
It's totally popular and fun.
Yeah, I want to go eat bacon right now.
I know.
Yeah.
And why bacon? I mean, it's great, but like so are bananas. Nobody's, you know.
Yeah, but.
Where's the banana marketers?
Right. Yep. Step up.
That's right.
Because it's so salty, it makes you thirsty. So I think it forces you to then continue to consume more of whatever it is that you're...
Well, I mean, it is delicious.
It is delicious. Mm-hmm. That helps. Because it's hard to market something less delicious so aggressively.
Right.
But that's true. That is marketing genius. And I'm sure there is somebody behind that. A company, a person, multiple people, whatever.
Right.
Somebody in the pork industry says, we need to sell more pork. Let's go promote bacon.
If you look at most of your food shows, except those that are health conscious, with your top chefs in local restaurants here, many of the recipes have cream, have bacon in them because it gives it flavor.
Yeah.
Delicious flavor.
Yummy.
Yum, yum.
I know. Where's our breakfast sponsor again?
I know.
Sorry.
We could use a little plate of bacon right now.
We could use some delicious bacon.
We'll have to work on that for next week.
So I think we should talk a little bit more in depth about you guys. What do you think?
Elizabeth, yeah,
should we do that?
I agree.
Yes.
Let's find out a little bit more. Now that we know our guests have such interesting perspectives on everything from Tide to bacon.
That's right. Now we can let them loose in the studio.
Exactly.
Let them run around like crazy people.
So, Jennifer, your gallery has a lot of interesting projects going on currently.
Yes.
How long have you owned the Jennifer Schwartz Gallery?
The Jennifer Schwartz Gallery.
What was that gallery called again?
Right.
Oh.
It's hard to remember.
The Jennifer Schwartz Gallery. And where is it located, actually, before you launch into that?
It is on the west side of Atlanta.
Okay.
Right where Howe Mill hits Marietta.
Yep.
In the Brickworks complex.
In the super trendy, awesome, popular neighborhood.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly.
So now, sorry, back to you.
Yes. I've been in that location for a year. I've had the gallery for about almost 3 years.
And how did you get started in that?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah, it is.
I am a commercial photographer, and I was looking for a new commercial space for my studio. I also make pictures, fine art pictures, and I collect photography. And when I was looking for space, I found a space that was larger than what I needed for my studio, and I was like, oh, I'll do a little gallery in the front. I literally think I said those words. I'll do a little gallery in
It'll
the front.
It'll be no big deal.
Yeah, it'll be so fun, and it is so fun. It's a little bit more involved than just painting the walls
original.
White.
Then I'll do a little gallery. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. But
well, now you do so much.
Yes.
I
think that it's been a really interesting... I love a challenge. I love just diving into something. And for me, it's been ultimately really a positive thing that I didn't have. I hadn't worked in a gallery before. I hadn't tried to get my own photographs in a gallery. So I came at it. I do come at it from a completely different perspective at a time when I think that the traditional gallery model is struggling. So whereas a lot of people that have been in this business for a long time are saying like, oh, that's not the way it's always been done or that'll never work. I don't think of it that way. I'm looking at it from a completely different perspective. All the other stuff, you know, how thick your mat should be and what kind of lighting and how to invoice. I mean, that's stuff that's pretty
standard.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think coming at business creatively like that is what is why certain people succeed. Because if you get too stuck in a box,
absolutely,
that's why, you know, the industries as a whole start to tank. It's not one business that tanks. The whole thing starts to go, right?
You know, and I also, my focus from the beginning has really been to support photographers.
Right.
And so all that I'm doing comes back to that. And so, you know, I collect photography. I am a photographer. A lot of my close friends are photographers. I understand the struggle of trying to get your work out there. And so it all sort of goes back to working with them.
And the photographs on your website are really and in the gallery are very unique. And you've tackled some interesting topics from like things that are going on in our environment that aren't very pretty necessarily to see, but are very important to have the awareness of and to capture that experience. So what inspired some of the pieces that you've chosen to focus on?
Sure. We represent 16 different photographers in the gallery. We show their work as well as we'll do group concept shows of other people that we don't necessarily represent. The main distinction is that we show photographers that are emerging or mid-career, meaning people that are just starting to get their names out. And one thing that I think is really important about photography and wonderful about photography is, and part of it ties into my whole crusade, is that it's contemporary. We all get it. We know how it's done. We all take pictures. And there's something for everyone. I mean, so you have this environmental portraiture like the Jeff Rich show that we have up right now. Only through Saturday. And then
get it while it's hot.
Right. And then you can have something like, you know, beautiful, lyrical, black and white, romantic, and it's all photography. It's all the same medium. I feel lucky that I have a wide range of tastes. I own pieces from almost everyone that
I
show.
Well, that's what's cool. Just going through your gallery, you go through a wide range of emotional experience. And it's all something that captures some type of visceral emotional experience in you.
And typically, someone who's just starting to buy art probably isn't going to buy the photograph of the nuclear power plant. I mean, that's a generalization. But you tend to start with things that are a little bit more relatable or just accessible, I guess the word is. But the more you see and the more you start to develop your tastes, a lot of people do move into that more lyrical documentary style.
Well, I might buy the nuclear power plant because I have a course on ethics and technology as well as ethics in the arts and film.
Right, so it relates. I mean, and for example, my husband and I collect photography. I obviously see a lot more photography than he does, so it's been interesting in thinking about building collectors for the gallery and in the world in general, just getting younger people invested in art, thinking about my own sort of trajectory, like progress through the work that we bought in the beginning, more landscapes and pretty things.
Right.
And now I have two.
Now she's more sophisticated.
Now I'm more sophisticated.
That's right.
I'm still in the pretty things of my art collecting.
The two I have, I own two photographs that are in the Jeff Rich show right now. And one is this photograph of this man, Steve Harris. And he's really ratty looking, I guess, for lack of a better word. And the other is a photograph of his house, which is kind of a shacky cabin.
Eccentric.
Yes. And so, and when I first saw that image, I mean, it just blew my mind. I was like, this is unbelievable. I showed it to my husband. I said, we're getting this. And he's like, we're going to hang a picture of a homeless man in our house. And I was like, no, we're getting his house, too. He lives right here. You know, we'll have both. It'll be great. But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a different.
Well, I think that brings up an interesting question for me because I know I haven't really bought anything in a long time, but I went through periods of my life where I was more interested in collecting art. And I think photography was one thing that always sort of escaped me. Like, I wasn't really ever sure how to judge the quality. I've never heard of this photographer, so is this somebody that is going to, not that you're buying art because it's going to be worth something.
No, I mean, it's a consideration.
But it's an investment. Sure. And so, I don't want to buy from somebody that is...
Right.
That
well,
is crap,
I think the
you know?
Difference between coming to my gallery and going to like an art fair and buying a photograph there is that if you can't buy anything bad for me. You know, I'm telling you, these are people, I'm out there, I know what's going on, and these are the people that are really moving forward in their careers.
And each piece of art has its own story.
Absolutely. There's a lot of layers of depth to yes. them. So, you know, even though a lot of the images I show are pretty,
right.
There's a lot more to the body of work and the story than just, you know, a photographer taking pictures of rainbows and unicorns. I mean, there's really
Wait, can you find a unicorn to photograph?
You would be surprised.
Okay, just yeah. checking.
Mm-hmm. There might be some. They're out there. So you've done a lot to, like, encourage the interest of collecting, and you're on a crusade.
I am on a crusade, mm-hmm. which, yeah. So in my whole, I sort of breathe ideas, and when I get one, which happens a lot, then I feel compelled to do it. And some are not as insane as other ones. But in thinking about who is my target person to buy photography from my gallery. So I show photography, which is, like I said before, it's accessible. We all get it. It's very contemporary, sort of appeals to younger people, and it's more affordable. It's a lot more affordable than, you know, generally than painting or sculpture. So right. it's a very, and there is that something for everyone component. So it is a great place to start when you're just starting buying art. Mm-hmm. So my target person is someone who is just starting to think about buying art, or who hasn't thought about buying art yet, but would if I told them how cool it was.
Right.
Yes.
It's like photography is the gateway.
Mm. Exactly.
Exactly. Art, I love that line when you said that.
So the gateway drug to larger collecting is what I call my my online project, The 10. So how do you rustle up these people that do, you know, I'm saying exist, you know, but where to find them? Because they're not people that are already attending art events typically, but mm-hmm. you know, a younger, and by younger I mean 20s to 40s, not, but people that we all care about the things in our world. We're really invested and curious, and we're kind of seekers. We want to know where our food is coming from and how our coffee's roasted. And, you know, we care about the things sure. in our world. And so mm-hmm. art is a natural fit into that, something that we would be interested in learning about and mm-hmm. getting
right.
deeper into.
Very much a part of natural humanity as
it
you
is.
Look at
yeah
evolving.
But you know, sort of the problem is that it's so easy to go to IKEA and get some prefab thing, and there's nobody standing at the register saying, I don't think you want to do that.
You could stand there and do that, that'd be fun,
right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's sort of what I'm trying to do,
right,
but
head
and,
off.
Right,
but not
right.
get arrested.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know, get them off of the path. Like, it doesn't have to even be more expensive, but just buy something that's original.
Sure.
Buy something that where you're supporting, mm-hmm. like I said, it goes back to the photographers, where you're supporting an artist directly, where you have the opportunity to meet that artist, where you can learn about their work and become yeah. one of their mm-hmm. collectors. That, you know, a lot of Jeff Rich's images are beautiful and not so, they don't look like a nuclear power plant. But it is part of this series that is about the environment. So there are layers of depth. You can come to the mm-hmm. Art Feast dinner tonight if it wasn't sold out and meet him.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, there are a lot of mm-hmm. opportunities to walk into your house, to see something on your wall, and have a really positive and layered reaction to it that you won't get if you buy the big daisy canvas.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know?
Well, art has to appeal to a person's story and their life
right.
story. And,
right.
and that way they are able to resonate with it and connect with it and have identity with that piece of art and what their history has been.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, why wouldn't we all, we care about how we look and what we put on every day mm-hmm. and what message that gives to the world. Why don't we want the walls in our home to be a reflection of who we are?
Oh, absolutely. Which is going to have depth, which is not
right.
all going to be,
and it's going to be original.
Think, right.
It's going to be original
the
to you. You know, it's not
art.
Like I have this and so do 8,000 other people right. that went to IKEA that week.
Right.
Like an Elvis painting in your living room.
Right. Right. So in thinking about that and thinking, you know, it made me frustrated that we aren't doing this and that there is nobody standing at the register or, you know, standing on a soapbox mm-hmm. and saying, support art, you know, be, if we don't do this, then we don't have our growing group of, you know, as we age, collectors who are supporting and patronizing the arts. And so, so I started this crusade for collecting is what I call it. And I do an online project called The 10, where it's just lower priced, but still very collectible pieces. There are only 25 of each image ever printed. The photographers are signing it.
What is lower price?
$250.
Okay, just checking.
So, yes, good question.
Because for some people, lower price is like, oh, it's $3,000.
Yep.
It's cheaper than the $1 million.
$3,000. I mean, most of the things I have in the gallery framed are around $1,000.
Okay.
This is, which is also getting over that hurdle. I think a lot of people think, oh, I could never afford something mm-hmm. in a gallery. Most of the people that buy for me just, they pay over time.
Sure.
We end up going out for drinks. Like, here's $200 to go towards that piece. Yeah. I've got them, you know,
that's
over
great.
My bed. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, just keep it coming whenever.
Right, but $250 yep. is definitely more accessible for
right.
people.
Right, it's not an impulse buy, but mm-hmm. most, probably all of our bags cost more than that.
Don't tell people that.
Once you've invested in a really quality piece of artwork, you really see the value
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely.
And you understand, I don't know that you understand the value until you've made that investment and bought something that's a couple thousand dollars
right.
and you're like, wow,
right.
this really mm-hmm. it was such a great buy.
And you'll have it forever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it will go up in value. I mean, it's...
Exactly.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. Do you ever have people come to you and ask to you to value something they already own?
No. I mean, that's not, there are people that do that.
And, but do people ask, like, is that something, because in other words, I I'm not a serious collector, but I have been, I'm a little older, and so I've been collecting art for a while, mm-hmm. and I have things that I wonder sometimes, like, I'm never going to sell them, so I don't really need to know, I don't
right.
really care, but I'm
right.
just sort of curious if they've gone up in value, you know?
Yeah.
Well, if you have a flood in your house, which we did a number of years ago,
yikes,
and you have to get things valued, then you'll find out what the value is for insurance purposes.
But that's it's gone.
Right, that's an important question, though.
Yep.
Should people do that ahead of time? So that
oh, absolutely.
We do.
Yeah.
We have
and take photographs.
Insurance.
Every couple years or something, do you just have, should you have somebody come back in and reassess what you have? Because
I think
if the artist, I mean, knock on wood, if the artist dies or something, it probably goes up in value even more. Maybe you didn't know that. And then,
knock on wood that they
yep.
don't die.
Yes.
Okay.
Unless you're just all about the money. But
right.
we'll
you're
talk
like,
about that when we get
wood,
to ethics.
The value goes up.
Yeah, knock on wood, everyone dies and my art becomes worth millions.
Right.
No.
Well, everyone
nope.
does die eventually. It's just a matter of the
when.
Order.
That's right.
Yeah.
When.
And if any, yeah. And if the work was ever good to begin with.
Right. Of course. Of course. Yeah.
So the crusade is to try to encourage people to buy original
jump
work
in on
and,
the
yeah,
art
and
collection.
Do it. And so when I created this website, The 10, to me, this was the gateway drug to larger collecting, to getting people used to buying work, hanging it, feeling that connection, wanting more. The photographer that we feature every month does a collection of 10 images, and they're all part of one body of work, and they write about it. So even if you don't love the 10 that is launched that month, just reading about it and seeing how the images relate to each other, you're self-educating. You're getting a better understanding that photographers don't just walk around and take pictures that
are, oh, that's pretty. I'll
right,
take a picture
right.
of it. Yeah,
sure.
You know, they work within, they have a serious concept, and the images that they are making are created to fit into that project.
Right.
So so I do this whole thing, the 10. That was my one idea.
Really awesome. Now,
and
about
then,
the walk away with art.
Oh, the
can
walk away with art.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And that... Just to backtrack so that, because I did mention one of my more insane ideas, and that is I made this website, The 10, we did this project, and I was like, that's great, but how do you really get it out there? We're all so saturated with things online, and I was like, why don't mm-hmm. I drive
yes.
around the country and sell art? And so I'm doing that. So I bought...
and if you had to have a vehicle to take such a crusade,
right.
obviously the one you would pick
would be a 1977 Volkswagen bus,
of
teal
course.
Blue,
sure.
that, as I learned, and there's a video on the 10 Crusade website of me trying to drive this beast. Lady Blue, I call her, so that she will like me. I mean, it's...
A little bohemian culture here.
It was like the stick shift of terror. This thing was, it was intense. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to need some lessons. That's in a year.
So you haven't actually taken off yet.
Yes, I got the bus. I'm doing a bus bash party at Wonderoot on the 14th. And little trials. And I'm going to actually take a short trip.
Good idea.
To do a pop-up show in a not too far away city before I do 10 weeks all around the country.
Do a trial, pilot it.
Yes.
See how it goes and tweak it.
Yes. And then, so, in thinking about that I'm going in a year to, you know, hawk my wares out of a bus.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to be giving talks, and I have been already, about this whole idea, this whole crusade for collecting. And when I'm out there on the road, I want to be able to say, like, these people do exist, and I have found them in Atlanta, you know, that I've been able to do this, to cultivate this younger crop of collectors. They're not just these, like, mythological people that I'm talking about. Like, I want to be able to say, so then it becomes like, okay, literally, how do I find these people, and how do I get them into the gallery and get them engaged and interested? So we have been doing a couple of branded events, reoccurring branded events, and one, which is coming up on the 13th of April, is called Walk Away with Art. And the idea, and it's super fun, and it hits a lot of these goals sort of all in one program. So I get 7 of my photographers to give me 7 different images. One gives me 8. So I have 50 different images up around the gallery in a really nice size, like a 13x19 size. And we sell 50 tickets for $100 a piece. And when you come in, when you have one of these tickets, and it's when you have a ticket, you come in and you pull a number from 1 to 50. And that's the order you get to pick any piece off the wall. And a lot of the photographers are there, so you get to hear them speak about their work. And you're also, as opposed to going to just an opening, which are also really fun, but where you're just drinking wine and talking to your friends,
you
and you're like, this stuff's great. You're really
night.
Looking at every single piece because you're trying to figure out what you like and what your strategy is and how to knock down the person next to you who has a higher number. So you're really getting a sense. You're starting to figure out, like, wow, it looks like I keep all the pieces I'm drawn to are from this photographer and that photographer, and this photographer's right there. I can go talk to her and meet her, and I can hear she's going to give a talk, so I can hear her story. And then it was amazing.
That's
and then you walk away with art. You are a collector. You have a signed original piece. And then, too, even if you don't really, you know, if Kathleen Robbins is talking about her work and you're like, it's not really my style, but you do get a deeper level of appreciation hearing her talk about it. And then when you get an email 6 months from now that she's having a show at the gallery, you're a lot more likely to come because you've met her and you've seen the work and you already have this buy-in.
And you've started your collection.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of people... I specifically choose 7 photographers with really different aesthetics from each other. And so even people that had numbers in the 30s were still getting their first choice because everyone sort of liked something different. And a lot of people, too, which I thought was wonderful, changed their minds about what piece was their favorite or which ones they were going to go for after hearing the photographer speak.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a really great event.
And I think I saw that if you want to come as a couple, you can, it's
$125,
but you still walk away with one piece of art as a couple.
Right. If as a couple you each want,
then you two separate
you
tickets.
$200
But so if you're bringing a date, you can be like, dude, you can come with me, but it's my art.
Right. I get
you
it.
You walk away with the pleasure of my company.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And it's a really fun party.
Sure. Yeah. Sounds like it.
Yeah.
I bet.
Food, drink.
I look forward to visiting your studio.
Yes, please
Absolutely.
Do.
So let's meet Tom now.
Let's.
And,
he's been such a good sport.
About Ethics Firma. So Tom, you were in the military background, and on your website you talk about how the Marine Corps discovered in the mid-1990s that men and women joining didn't have the skills to make good ethical decisions.
That's correct.
So this is interesting to realize that our military realized at this time frame, you know what, ethical decisions are going to be critical and clearly are critical as part of what the military does. And we need to come up with a way to give people a framework, I guess it is.
That's exactly right. Come up with a framework. And what they realized that the young men and women coming in the mid-90s just didn't have those decision-making skills. And ethics was relative to what they thought was right. And so when you have that kind of situation, it's difficult to have people to follow you. And you definitely have to have discipline and order in the military. So we developed a program. It's called the Core Values Classes. It's an Ethics 101, Group Values, Personal Values, Courage, and Commitment. So that was the basis of the program. Since that time, over the years since I left, and they've done a much better job than when I was there, because when you start with the seminal work,
so modest.
Obviously, it takes a lot to get it up to speed. And
sure.
Now have what they call values-based training. And it's really one of the best programs anywhere for ethics for young men and women. In fact, 2 years ago, I took a group of executives from here in Atlanta, from Coca-Cola, UPS, Southern Company, Assurant, and some others, to Paris Island to see the ethics program. And they were absolutely blown away with the intensity that ethics is ingrained, enculturated through all the training from the time the recruit meets the recruiter till the time that they graduate. So thinking of that concept at the time, and if this is true of the Marine Corps bringing in young men and women, which is a good sample of cross-section, then
right.
It's also true of men and women in business.
Sure.
It's even the same people. And so I've done a little bit of research and talking with people, and no doubt that some of the people that I talk with, executives, say one of the biggest problems I have is young men and women in my young executive staff have a hard time making moral decisions. And I think it's because, some might say the disintegration of the family structure, having meals
seems
at
like
home.
Right and wrong should be at the very basic level
that
of
is
what we know.
Very
and
basic.
Yet it's amazing to think that we can be educating our youth to such an extent throughout the entire education system, mm-hmm. and yet still have people in their early 20s who can't successfully navigate the gray area. And I was just thinking about the transition here from art and the gray area to the
nicely
gray
done.
Area.
Well,
here.
Yeah.
So
in that respect,
not black and white.
No, it's not black and white. And if you're operating down on the level of right and wrong, that is where you have your desires overwhelming your ability to make cognitive decisions to do the right thing, because what you want that to satisfy your desire, and it may be a wrong thing.
Those pesky
desires. It's interesting because I have been in and out of corporate America mm-hmm. many times in my career, and I opt for out more often than in. And one of the reasons is because I feel like I have a pretty high moral and ethical code, and mm-hmm. I cannot stand when people, they have this mentality that if it's legal, it's okay. And just because something's legal or doesn't break a law doesn't mean it's
ethical.
Right.
Good. Exactly.
Good moral behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Or the right choice, or
sure.
good for humanity, or good for the business even, really, mm-hmm. at the end of the day. And people lose sight of that. They get so focused on a goal. We need to make this much money today,
right.
whatever mm-hmm. the cost. And they forget even about the long-term value for the company. If someone mm-hmm. finds out that you chose this unethical behavior,
yes.
even if you made money on this project, mm-hmm. you're going to be doomed.
Absolutely, because there are inherent risk in that kind of thinking.
Right.
And this is a higher level of thinking. When you have competing values that go against one another, they both look right, and which one do I need to take? And when you have those competing values, decision-making is much more complex.
Sure.
So you have to have some type of moral decision-making model to work through that.
So because it's interesting that we mentioned the law, and because we have such a litigious society today, I mean, more so than ever before, and yet I wonder, as that part of, the world or the governing body has expanded, it's made it more difficult to make moral decisions, basic raw right and wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
Versus the complexity of the law.
Three drivers of ethics. It's technology, government regulations, and personal conduct. And for technology, we can take the example of corn. Corn has been a tremendous commodity that has fed us throughout our lives. Well, ethanol became the solution for our environmental issues with automobiles. So the price of corn skyrocketed.
Right.
Our bread, our meats, and anything that has corn in it skyrocketed.
Which I don't think people realize everything has corn in it.
Right.
You said meat, and people go, what do you mean? Well, corn-fed animals. Hello.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ubiquitous in the food chain.
Technology of ethanol is not that efficient. It can only be used in 10% of gasoline.
Right.
And so the end result, which no one thought about, is that the poorest of the poor in other countries are now disadvantaged because of the high prices.
Right.
Of corn. So that's
global
one
market.
Example.
Well, because the whole reason ethanol became sort of the answer is because, I mean, it's very complicated, obviously. We don't need to go all into that. Mm-hmm. But it was because all the oil lobbyists, blah, blah, blah. There are other better solutions that are cheaper and can be used more and things like that. But, you know, that could be a whole other ethical problem.
A good political soundbite as well.
And I'm not even yelling, though.
So no, not even yelling. The other aspect, when we look at regulation, in the 1980s, there were 55,000 pages of federal regulation. Today, there's over 165,000 pages of federal regulation.
Wow.
So what might have been an ethical issue or even a misdemeanor issue has now become a felony.
Wow.
It can become a felony because of the changes of laws and interpretation of laws. So you can no longer, you know, get away with things that we would consider minor, where used to they would call your parents to come get you and, you know, take you home and discipline
Everyone
you.
Raise their hand if that happened to you. It's radio. No one will tell.
Yeah. So now you end up going to jail and being charged with a crime. For instance, just the students, 22 students vandalized a high school, the seniors, with spray paint.
Right. Graffiti. Yeah.
That would have been a call your parents thing.
That would have been.
Yeah.
Now they're looking at charging them with a felony arrest.
Wow.
So think about what that will do for their careers in the future with a felony at 18 and graduating high school.
Oh, yeah.
Awful.
It really would stunt your...
And then the third thing is our personal conduct. And we look at media. Media such as Facebook, Twitter, and other media... are the primary drivers for learning values this day and time.
That like puts
that
a that like
so
sends I know I'm like
right
terrified
right?
by that.
I know we're
terrified.
Learning our values from
Well, employers look at your Facebook page
sure.
to see what you're saying about them.
Absolutely,
sure.
How
if
you conduct
smart.
Yourself on Facebook. Now, if you go for an interview, they're going to look and do research and all over the internet to determine what you're saying or have said or written.
I give a talk on photography in the age of social media, and
mm-hmm.
that's a huge point that we say because I talk to students a lot that do not post those drunken naked pictures
no.
from that party on Facebook. They
right.
are out there,
that's
and they
right.
get forwarded,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
you can't get them back. And
right.
And it's true that employers do look,
mm-hmm.
and, you know,
there's so much transparency today
there
in
is.
This age of the social media.
But there's
and
also,
internet.
There's no, there's such little, you can say something to someone or make a snarky comment on Facebook. There's so little recourse. You're not having to stand in front of someone and say
right.
that
People
thing.
Don't have the filter that they
Absolutely.
Might have
Absolutely. You
had
can
on.
Be a lot more inappropriate yeah. because you're, in a lot of ways, there's
like
a lot of anonymity.
People
Even
say
though it's
things.
A transparent curtain.
Right.
People say things behind the screen in their room with the door closed
sure.
that they do not have the moral courage to say to people face to face.
Absolutely.
And so it's a coward's way out to sit behind their screen and post comments that are bullying other people's, slandering other people. And they are haven't the courage to take a stand and confront the person about the real issue that they're dealing with. And I think this has led to an increased bullying for young people in particular. It also creates Sherry Turkle wrote a book called Alone Together. And even though we are social beings, that we're creating a life that is marginalizing our abilities to deal with other people, to develop emotional intelligence, and to make the moral decisions, because we escape responsibility and accountability in that respect to social media.
It's really scary. I worry about kids today. You know, I mean, I think I was talking to somebody just the other day about cheating and lying and dishonesty and that type of thing. And, you know, back in the day, we were sort of told, and this was all obviously before all the computer stuff, but we were sort of told, you know, if you wouldn't, if you don't want the other person, if you're doing something you don't want your partner to know about, whatever it is, that's cheating. Yep. If you have to do something and not tell me about it, you shouldn't be doing it, right? Like if you're the parent and a kid, you say to your kid, look, if this is something you can't be upfront with me about, you probably shouldn't be doing it in the first place.
My father-in-law says, if you don't want it printed on the front of the paper tomorrow,
don't do it. Right. And the kids today, I think, are losing track of that because they're so desensitized. Everybody's doing it, whatever it is, on Facebook.
But who reads the paper?
Now it's on Facebook, really.
Right, right.
So I think the new lesson for our kids probably should be, if you don't want a potential employer to see it on, you know, to see it for a job interview, don't freaking do it.
Right.
You know, it's
certainly don't post about it. I mean, it was us growing up, don't do it and don't get caught.
Right.
Now
right.
it's like, you know, don't do it and brag about it to, you know, a million people. I think it's really interesting. My Facebook I use for business and Twitter and all of that. And so I'm very cognizant of what I'm putting out there, things that are personal, but it's all about the brand.
Right.
But I have a lot of friends who I don't literally know who they are. They're photo people. It's okay.
Right.
We have 150 friends in common. Sure, I'll accept you. But then, you know, back to the inappropriate comments and there are a lot of, I just posted the picture right before this of like, oh, I'm getting ready for my Business Radio X thing. And someone wrote me a creepy message.
Oh.
I'm like, now I have to defriend this person I don't even know.
Well, it's narcissism. People want to be famous.
Yeah.
And they want their minute of fame, whether it be through YouTube or whatever.
Right. And reality TV is
reality
also,
television. Yeah, just, and so narcissism, it's all about me, it's my life, and the only thing that matters are my values. And we always want other people to change their values.
Yeah.
And I'm okay. I'm a good person.
Right.
And so I can do what I want. But don't you come back on me. And that's kind of an attitude of a typical narcissist who's looking for fame or fortune or whatever their motive is, or just to bully someone without accepting responsibility. And so, you know, by getting the nasty email.
Creepy.
It's
creepy.
It was creepy. They felt empowered and that they had a lot of power over you. And obviously that individual has some personal issues.
Well, they have no power. I'm defriending. I have the power.
Yeah. And that's right.
So, Tom, how do we create a solid moral framework in times when things are so difficult like this?
Well, I think it takes continual reinforcement of teaching ethics and ethics advising, which I do with Ethics Firma, and creating a greater awareness. As I was speaking with someone yesterday, a gentleman told me that who was an accountant said, well, I'm taking an ethics class right now, and we're talking about accounting ethics and personal conduct, and we started talking about ethics of technology. He said, I never thought about that. And I said, actually, if you think about it, technology has one of the biggest drivers, because it's why we have this whole issue with birth control right now.
Yeah.
And other issues that you look at. And, you know, where is our moral thinking? Is it constrained? Is it small? Are we down on this right versus wrong level? Because we need to learn to exercise a moral muscle each and every day in order to expand our moral capacity to engage with the more complex issues.
Yeah.
And my thinking is that as technology continues to get far beyond our abilities to understand it, our ability to engage it morally is shrinking as a society. So it creates a tremendous gap. And so this is part of my I guess you could say my agenda, my mission is to...
Your crusade.
Crusade,
as it were.
Absolutely.
You want to get on the bus?
Yeah, get on the bus. Yeah. I'll get on the blue bus.
Right, exactly. And Lady Blue. There's
fact,
room.
I teach a course on ethics and art and how that we can develop our critical thinking skills through watching movies or interpreting art. I taught graduate courses, and I would use movies for exams, and they would have to take the moral theory, leadership theory, watch the movie, and pick seven scenes out, and then discuss it with that theory and
that
how it applied
really
in the scene, and then also bring their own personal experience into it. And it was different than the traditional case studies that they have in business school, where you have a piece of paper with a short story and three or four questions, because they were able to engage the emotions and the facial features or the body language of the actors in the film. And one of the best ones that I've used for a final exam was the movie Doubt with Meryl Streep. Where there is no answer in that movie, because... The question, is she an overbearing, strict disciplinarian as a leader, and everything is by the rules? Or Father Flanagan, who is the easygoing, compassionate individual who tries to make this young African-American child, who is the first African-American student in the 1960s, feel comfortable? And you see where Sister Aloysius, Meryl Streep's character, thinks that Father Flanagan is a pedophile. And implicates that. And so it really is a dilemma there to work through and try to make a decision. My students always says, this is the best exam I've ever taken. It was the hardest exam I've ever had.
I could see that.
But I learned more in this and using this process. Another example, and speaking of static art, is Rembrandt's photograph or painting of Bathsheba with David's letter. And then Dürer, his student, did the same type of painting with Bathsheba's letter. And there's an interpretation of those two. On one hand, with Rembrandt's painting, Bathsheba's looking at the letter like, this looks like fun. David's really giving me a challenge here and in getting involved in this love relationship. On the other hand, Dürer's is, I'm being put between the rock and a hard place. David's using his power against me. And should I remain faithful to my husband, Uriah? And so here's where you can find those layers of depth, as you were talking about in art. And be able to develop your critical thinking skills. And this obviously goes beyond the basic right versus wrong type of issues.
So kind of, we could have done like a 3-hour ethics and art seminar,
totally.
I think.
You
it's
could,
fascinating.
Absolutely.
You guys will have to come back for that.
I know. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time for this morning. But thank you guys so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been fascinating.
Sure, Tom, your website, go ahead and tell folks what that is.
Website is www.ethicsfirma, that's ethixfirma.com, like firm ethics.
Excellent.
You've got a lot of great resources, a blog that you talk regularly about ethical issues that have come up in the news, and some resources for decision making, which is very cool. So check that out.
There's always something to talk about with ethics.
Oh my gosh, that's what I'm saying. We could go for hours. Yeah. My goodness. And then Jennifer, your website?
My gallery website is jenniferschwartzgallery.com. So Schwartz with the S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z.
Yeah.
And
I like Schwartz with a, and then she spells the whole thing. That's awesome.
And the 10 is the 10 photo spelled out, T-H-E-T-E-N-P-H-O-T-O.com. If you want to follow the crusade shenanigans, that would be the10photo.com/crusade.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys again so much for being here. This has been Good Morning Atlanta, and we will be back next week with more business headlines, more awesome guests, more begging for breakfast, less traffic, all that good stuff. Have a great day. We'll see you next time.